And now let's begin with Dr. Martin Williams. He is a clinical and forensic psychologist. He consults and testifies nationwide before psychotherapy and health care regulatory boards regarding ethics matters. He has served on the Ethics Code Task Force of Psychologists in Independent Practice. Do you have a little acronym for that somehow, Marty? No acronym for this? Oh, and that is a division of the APA. So let us now welcome Dr. Martin Williams.
Thank you, Al. One thing I want to mention about the APA task force, that's the Ethics Code Task Force that created the current code revision. As I'll be getting to later in the talk today, many people, including myself, now feel that there's something deeply flawed in that code, and I want to be talking about that, something that we didn't foresee when we solved some of the problems that were solved in the code. I wasn't actually on the Ethics Code Task Force. I was an official observer from the division of APA called Psychologists in Independent Practice, and we had a lot of issues about the ethics code because the ethics code is used against independent practitioners more than against anyone else. And it was originally written as a document to guide the APA Ethics Committee, and it has been exported from the APA to most states' licensing laws. And so the ethics code is often used by people who are not psychologists, who have no training in psychology, namely civil jurors or administrative law judges, and the code is used to adjudicate psychologists. So anyone who can read can see what's in the code, but it seems like the code should require an understanding of psychology before it's used. So anyway, that was what was driving the Division of Independent Practice in trying to get the code clarified so that these non-psychology users would have a more difficult time in using it against us. But as I'll be getting to, there are some problems that we solved that ended up creating new problems. I want to mention this handout that's going around. I just got these in the mail from the publisher, and I thought since I was coming here, I just passed them on to you. I actually think that this is a book I co-authored, Surviving a Licensing Board Complaint, What to Do and What Not to Do. This is one of the few books that's not about, in the field of ethics and enforcement, that's really not about ethics. It's about survival. So this is not a book to tell you what's right and what's wrong. It tells you how to cope. And the people in this room, since most of you are forensic psychologists, need this book far less than most psychologists because you know how the court system works. So if the licensing board were ever to call you up, if a board investigator were ever to call you up and say, look, we've got this complaint, can we get together and talk about it and settle it informally? I don't think we need to involve lawyers. We just want to, you know, get together and have a talk. I think most of the people in this room would know that the correct answer to that request is no way. But I think a lot of clinicians are far more naive. So this book is really written to give people advice on how to deal with a licensing board complaint if they haven't had the experience of dealing with boards in the past or with courts. Okay, so how do I do this? Bang. All right. I'm going to be talking about three developments in ethics as part of this ethics and law update. And the three developments are certain malpractice carriers, including some who insure some of you. I'd like to know, anybody here insured by the American Professional Agency in Amityville, the Amityville Horror? Okay. Well, you listen up. I'll be talking about your insurance company. One topic I'm going to be covering is that some insurers have added a poison pill to malpractice policies that could lower your coverage. You think you got $1 million coverage, you think you got $3 million coverage. Under certain circumstances, with the right borderline accusing you, your coverage is $25,000. You think I'm making that up, but I'll explain it. They will pay your defense costs, but, I mean, if you lose, $25,000 is your coverage limit. Another development is that the American Psychological Association Insurance Trust abandoned its massive campaign of promoting risk management. And I'll tell you why they did that, but to give you a preview, it's because risk management creates a new standard of care. And I'll explain how that works. But basically, they figured out that they were working against themselves by creating more lawsuits and by making lawsuits easier for plaintiffs to win. And the third point I'm going to be covering is many important psychologists, including Kenneth Pope, who has written probably more books on ethics than anyone else in our field, have quit the APA because the new version of the ethics code, the 2002 revision, basically has wording in it that supports the Nuremberg defense. And those of you who studied history know that you even learned that, I think, in elementary school or something, that the Nuremberg defense is not valid. Well, we'll get to that, but the APA code supports it. It's in it. The Nuremberg defense is in the APA ethics code. Nuremberg defense, if you don't know, is I was just following orders. That's the defense. Okay. The poison pill. In the good old days, well, if you were a plaintiff's attorney, you could be really, you were really rolling in the 1970s and 1980s because a lot of therapists were having sex with their patients. And a lot of these, and there wasn't the massive education program that came since. And therapists didn't even know that it would mean the end of their careers. And maybe for some it didn't mean the end of their careers. But anyway, there were multi-million dollar awards, settlements, judgments. And one attorney here in San Francisco, John Weiner, did very well with therapist-patient sex cases. Now, some people in the field believe that we actually owed it, as a profession, we owed it to our clients to pay those claims so that people propose that the idea of restricting malpractice coverage so that sex claims wouldn't be paid was actually unethical because as a group we should take care of patients who were victimized in that way. But that position did not hold sway, and the malpractice carriers got wise. And what they did was they said, sex is not part of psychotherapy. It's not a known and accepted risk of psychotherapy, so we're not going to cover sex claims anymore. But the rest of the policy remained intact. And so what happened as a result is that the good plaintiff attorneys became experts at all kinds of non-sexual boundary violations. And I mean, if you're going to have sex with a patient, you're going to presumably first engage in excessive self-disclosure and all kinds of experiences with the patient that do not constitute therapy and constitute a breakdown of boundaries. And because the policy was intact for everything except sex claims, the attorney would just not mention the sex claim and get the payout for the negligent breakdown in boundaries. So that was where things were And as far as I knew, up until a month ago, I just learned this very recently, I thought that was the present state of affairs. I thought, okay, as long as the plaintiff can show that there were other forms of negligent psychotherapy in addition to the sex, your policy was still in effect and the award would be covered. But the malpractice carriers got even wiser, and they decided, look, we know, oh, by the way, before I go on to that, I want to say that before the insurance carriers limited the sex claims and left intact the non-sexual boundary claims, before that, attorneys had no reason to become knowledgeable about the whole area of boundary violations and to become knowledgeable about the whole area of how to sue a psychologist for something other than sex. But because of the limitation on the sex claims, attorneys became more sophisticated about our entire ethics code. And I think that that's what caused a major increase in the entire endeavor of suing therapists. That attorneys had these egregious sex cases. They were pushed to learn about non-sexual boundary violations in order to get remunerated for the sex cases. And then they had all this knowledge and all this expertise, and they were in an ideal position to sue us for all kinds of other things. Okay. Then, now comes the poison pill. The American Professional Agency, and their policies are underwritten by a company called Darwin Insurance, did this. If, I'll give you a real life example that I'll make up. it could be in real life. Let's say you actually do something wrong to an angry borderline patient. Let's say you negligently violate the patient's confidentiality. Okay? You really did this. You made a mistake. You violated the patient's confidentiality. You're covered for $3 million. Now, let's say that the patient is so mad at you because you violated her confidentiality that she throws into her complaint, he also sexually molested me. He hugged me inappropriately, and it was very sexual. That's it. That's the poison pill. At this point, your malpractice policy is worth $25,000. I'll read you the language right out of, this is the little explanation that's given to policyholders. It was furnished to me by the APA Insurance Trust, a competitor with American Professional Agency. The APA Insurance Trust does not have this limit. Sexual misconduct. $25,000 is the most we will be liable to pay for all claims against you involving sexual misconduct by you or by any person for whom you may be legally responsible. If any sexual misconduct is alleged at any stage during a claim, all allegations in that claim which arise out of the same or related professional treatment or relationship will be subject to that $25,000 maximum. So that's something to look into. I was shocked. I knew nothing about it. And then, as I say, about a month ago, I'm consulting on a case, a defense case in Michigan. The attorney mentions it to me, and he says, you know, they're not mentioning sex. They think sex occurred, but the plaintiff is not even mentioning it because they don't want to ruin their chance to get a payout. And same thing in a California case. Okay, the American Psychological Association Insurance Trust has been offering risk management seminars all over the place. They were very aggressive. They had the idea, if we could get psychologists to be more cautious about their practice, not to think about the standard of care, but to think about risk management, meaning eliminate doing those things that may not be wrong, but they're just likely to get you sued, they thought they could reduce their claims. And what happened was they finally realized that risk management creates a new standard of care. And it goes like this. Let's say I'm a plaintiff attorney, and I've got the text of risk management courses that you, the defendant, has attended. And I've got information, I've got an expert that says, yes, this is widely known risk management advice. For example, you should never, if you're a heterosexual male therapist, you should never see a female patient alone in your office late in the day after everybody has gone home when you're the only one in the office and it's late in the day. Why shouldn't you do that? Because if there's a claim that you had sex, there are no witnesses to really back you up, no witnesses there to say what went on. Well, these risk management things get repeated and repeated and repeated. And then it gets to the point where it begins to appear negligent in and of itself for you to take that risk of seeing the patient late in the day when nobody else is in the office. I'll give you an example of how this has happened in another field. If you go back maybe 20 years, the idea of a doctor who does a pelvic examination, the idea of the doctor calling in a nurse or another staff member to witness it, that was purely optional. That was risk management. See, that was, I'm going to have somebody here so that you can't make a claim that I did something inappropriate because there was a witness. Well, over time, that has evolved from risk management to the standard of care. In other words, it now appears that it's negligent to do a pelvic exam without calling in somebody to witness it. I mean, I suppose it can be explained if it was an emergency and so on and so forth. But all in all, this risk management advice evolves to become the standard of care. And the plaintiff attorney, what they want to ask you during your trial is, if you knew this was risky, and of course they don't distinguish between risk to you and risk to the patient. They say, if you knew this was risky, why did you expose your patient to this risk? And that's how it goes. So the APA Insurance Trust decided we got to go in a new direction. And they sent out this book, Assessing and Managing Risk in Psychological Practice, an Individualized Approach. And in this book, they no longer promulgate all the risk management advice they were promulgating. And, you know, what I mean by the risk management advice? No excessive self-disclosure, no hugging of patients, no meetings with patients outside the office, and so on and so forth. No going to patients' life events like weddings and so on and so forth. They dropped it. And in the book, they've got this kind of formula thing. I don't know. Somebody told them maybe it's good to look scientific. So they have an actual formula. Clinical risk equals P times C times D over divided by TF. And I don't know enough about math to know what it means that you multiply these risks versus add them. But anyway, P is patient risk characteristics, C is context, D is disciplinary consequences, and TF is therapist factors. So basically, you know, they're just saying, look at the situation and decide whether the risk is worth it. So they got out of that business. Okay, my last topic in terms of new developments in ethics is that APA, in the ethics code, section 1.02, it now includes the Nuremberg defense. And here it is. It's towards the bottom of the page. Section 1.02 of the APA Ethics Code, conflicts between ethics and law, regulations, or other governing legal authority. If psychologists' ethical responsibilities conflict with law, regulations, or other governing legal authority, psychologists make known their commitment to the ethics code and take steps to resolve the conflict. If the conflict is unresolvable by such means, psychologists may adhere to the requirements of the law, regulations, or other governing legal authority. So that's it. In other words, it's basically, and I'll tell you why it's there before I criticize it. Division 42, psychologists in independent practice, we were interested in inserting that second sentence in there, the part about how if it's unethical, it's okay to follow the law. Because remember Clinton's associate, Susan McDougal, who spent all that time in jail for civil contempt? Well, if you were, like, totally into ethics to the exclusion of anything else reasonable, and you were in some court proceeding where you were compelled to release your raw test data, and you deeply believed, hey, this is this includes the stimulus materials, because, like, this is pre-HIPAA, and they haven't separated the stimulus materials out on the answer sheets, and this also is stuff that shouldn't be released to non-psychologists. I refuse. Well, then the judge rules, you give it up or you face contempt. So this was kind of like an escape clause that was added to the ethics code so that psychologists could kind of get along in a world that had laws that didn't recognize the ethics of psychology. So that's what it's doing there. And also, you see the previous version from the 1992 code was really weird because it read like this. If psychologists' ethical responsibilities conflict with law, psychologists make known their commitment to the ethics code and take steps to resolve the conflict in a responsible manner. So those of us in Division 42, psychologists in independent practice, didn't want to have a line in the ethics code where we had to guess what the administrative law judge who was about to revoke our license considered a responsible manner. So that was too vague and it was too scary, so this sentence gets added. But what is this sentence? The sentence now says that you don't have to be ethical. If somebody gives you an order, hell with ethics. Well, the Ethics Code Task Force was meeting in 2000 and 2001, and there might have been, yeah, I think it ended in 2001. So this whole thing took place before there was any news about psychologists participating in interrogations and torture. But this becomes relevant now because even if you consider it unethical to engage in torture, which is one of the specialties of psychologists. In fact, the interrogation methods that are currently being used, all these controversial methods, as I understand it, were de-engineered from methods that had been developed to resist torture. They were de-engineered to use in interrogation by psychologists. Now, the APA has gone on record in a variety of ways because they were under tremendous pressure. The APA went on record condemning any forms of torture. And since you can't use the word torture because everyone will say, well, we don't torture, we only do this, that, or the other thing, which is not torture. So the APA has all these resolutions that are kind of hair-raising to read because they actually list every method that the APA condemns. So it's really gross, you know, it's thumb screws, rack, hanging. Well, no, it's not that extreme. But they do mention waterboarding, simulated execution, goes on and on. So the APA has condemned this, but the ethics code has not been fixed to resolve this problem with the Nuremberg defense. In fact, there are two things in the ethics code that some think need to be have fixed. One is resolving this line in section 1.02 that says you can follow the law even when it's unethical. And the other is every time the APA has come under pressure about bad stuff psychologists do to a certain population, the APA has amended the ethics code to protect that population. So there's stuff in the ethics code about animal welfare for experimental psychologists. There's stuff in the ethics code about people being assessed or evaluated who don't have the ability to consent. So some people are saying that in addition to section 1.02 that needs to be fixed, something needs to be added to the code itself to protect the rights of detainees whose psychologists may be working with. And, you know, one thing that the APA said, and there was a lot of buzz about this when the APA met in San Francisco last year. It was all over the media. The APA's position is that one of their many positions is that if an interrogation is going on and if a psychologist is present, that that helps humanize the interrogation. And I don't necessarily agree with that, because the way I size it up, you're a military psychologist. Right away, your buddies who are not military psychologists but who are regular military are looking at you and thinking you're not like them. Well, this is your opportunity to fit in. And you're not going to want to make waves. So I don't think it's true that the presence of a psychologist humanizes an interrogation. Anyway, how many people here have heard of Kenneth Pope? Right, he's a very, very well-known psychologist. He's a fellow of the APA. Let me read you his resignation letter from the APA. I thought this was really shocking, because this guy is Mr. Ethics. I think he's written 5 or 6 books on ethics, very well known, former head of the APA Ethics Committee. Okay, why I resigned from the American Psychological Association. The following letter was sent to APA President Alan Kasdan via FedEx, February 6, 2008. Dear Alan, with sadness I write to resign from the American Psychological Association. My respect and affection for the members, along with my 29-year history with APA, make this a hard and reluctant step. Chairing the Ethics Committee, holding fellow status in 9 divisions, and receiving the APA Award for Distinguished Contributions to Public Service, the Division 12 Award for Distinguished Professional Contributions to Clinical Psychology, and the Division 42 Award for Mentoring, reflect a few chapters in my APA history. I respectfully disagree with decisive changes that APA has made in its ethical stance during the past 6-plus years. These changes moved APA far from its ethical foundation, historic traditions, and basic values, and beyond what I can in good conscience support with my membership. I would like to note 2 examples of disagreement. First, the years since 9/11 brought concern over psychologists' work that affects detainees. APA has stressed psychologists' vital role regarding the use of ethical interrogations to safeguard the welfare of detainees and ways that psychologists help advance the cause of detainee welfare and humane treatment. Yet, in its ethics code, APA chose not to recognize any humane treatment requirements governing psychologists' work with detainees as enforceable standards. Historically, when concerns arose about the impact of psychologist behavior on groups at risk, APA moved decisively to create specific requirements and limitations in the ethics code's enforceable standards. These groups included persons for whom testing is mandated by law or governmental regulations, persons with a questionable capacity to consent, research participants, subordinates, client students, supervisees, and employees. Facing concerns about the impact of psychologist behavior on research animals, for example, APA created an enforceable standard supporting the humane treatment of laboratory animals. But for detainees, APA chose not to adopt any enforceable standards in the ethics code mandating humane treatment. The code's numbered ethical standards set forth enforceable rules of conduct. The code emphasizes that although other code sections should be given consideration, even the code's preamble and general principles are not themselves enforceable rules. APA's decision to adopt an enforceable standard regarding humane treatment of animals, but not to adopt an enforceable standard regarding humane treatment of detainees, turns APA away from its ethical foundation, historic traditions, and basic values that should endure even in the midst of post-9/11 risks and realities. My second area of disagreement concerns the ethics code that Council adopted August 21, 2002, which took effect June 1, 2003. The 2002 code echoes the earlier code in setting forth the following enforceable standard. If psychologists' ethical responsibilities conflict with regulations or other governing legal authorities, psychologists make known their commitment to the ethics code and take steps to resolve the conflict. But the 2002 code created a new enforceable standard, which I already read to you, so I'm going to skip a little because we're running out of time. This new enforceable standard, in my opinion, contradicts one of the essential ethical values voiced in the Nuremberg trials. Even in light of the post-9/11 historical context and challenges, I believe we can never abandon the fundamental ethical value affirmed at Nuremberg. An attempt to modify standard 1.02 was placed only in the, I can't read that word, but is it on there? Only in the, okay, so we'll do without it. I think he's talking about only in an unenforceable section. In the 5 years since creating this new enforceable ethical standard, in a sharp break with the past, APA chose to make no qualifications, restrictions, or other modifications. We're running out of time, but I just want to mention the APA does have a track record, when it needs to, very quickly to revise its ethics code. Because in 1989, the Federal Trade Commission was all over the APA because the ethics code did not allow certain types of advertising. And the FTC said this was restraint of trade. There was some kind of legal proceeding, and the APA did an emergency code revision in 1989. So the APA does have the ability to revise the ethics code at any time. And I think Dr. Pope's position is, why haven't they? It's been 6 years. Okay, I will use the remaining time. We have about 5 minutes left for questions and discussion.
I have this mobile mic. If any of you have trouble getting to the other mic, I'll try to get it to you if you need to. So raise your hand and I'll try to get it to you. Let's see.
The book that APA put out, the ethics book that they put out, you made reference to it, I think, sometime in the last year, and Dr. Brickland's wife, in fact, was one of the co-authors. It makes reference to to psychology licensing laws, you know, throughout the country, resting on the principle that having a license, being granted a license, is a privilege. And I'd be interested in your comments on that concept.
Well, that's the view of, that is the prevailing view. Not only is it a privilege, but that having a psychology license is all about protecting the consumer. And that's why any time there are proceedings against your license, It varies from state to state, but in a lot of states, including California, you as the license holder don't have the due process protections that you might expect in civil court. The playing field is very much tilted towards the consumer complainant. And in fact, in California, they still have the board still has the option to non-adopt the administrative law judge's decision. So you put up all your money for your defense, you get a lawyer, you have a hearing in administrative law court, and you win a favorable verdict. The Board of Psychology has the option to review your favorable verdict and set it aside. They can also set aside an unfavorable verdict, but I don't think they usually do.
A comment. On the issue of torture, a good bit for the lawyers. The National Lawyers Guild now, and probably soon the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, has called on California, University of California at Bolt Hall to dump John Yoo, the president's apologist for the torture is okay memorandum.
Oh, and by the way, thank you for bringing that up. I don't know what happened, but yesterday in the California legislature, they were supposed to move on a bill that would make it a violation for California psychologists to participate in interrogations.
It's my understanding that there's about 100,000 members of APA or somewhere in that neighborhood. And those of us who are concerned, as you clearly are, about unethical interrogations at these detention centers where people have no human rights, have withheld our dues. I wonder if you have any point of view about why, out of that huge number of members of APA, there's only about 300 or 400 of us across the country that have done that.
I don't know what's going on. I've really tried to figure out what is going on. What is the buzz in APA? What is the stance of APA? Why are they being so resistant? And I really don't quite follow it, although I do know there is a division of military psychology. APA does have constituents who are very different from most of us. But I really don't know why there's been so little publicity and why APA is so unresponsive.
Has the new list of specifics by APA satisfied Ken Polk and his concerns?
Well, I don't think so, because that list was out before he wrote his letter resigning. I think he believes that the ethics code has to stop being unethical. And by the way, these lists, these resolutions, they're all on the APA website. I was just going over them this morning. The most recent one was in February. But some think that the code needs to be revised. Thank you.